Hello and welcome to the West City Church podcast. If you'd like to get to know us more, find us at westcitychurch.com.au. We really hope that you're encouraged by today's message.
Sacraments are something that the church has. Is that better, Phil? Rob? Can you hear me? It couldn't before. Sacraments is something the church does that nobody else seems to understand. They're special events that have a significance in themselves, but also have a relationship to normal life, and they symbolise that aspect of normal life. We have three in our church. Other churches have two and seven and sometimes more than that, but our three are very interesting. Now, baptism, which Phil's already talked about, it's not just baptism, the service, which is a fantastic experience. If you want to have a good experience, turn up on the 19th, is it, Phil? But it leads into something else, being recognised as full members of the community, not that people who don't get baptised aren't, but it's sort of got a special level. The second sacrament, which follows immediately after, is the foot washing. It's not treated as a sacrament in many churches, and I think it should be, because Jesus told us to wash one another's feet. But he was not talking about feet. He was talking about lives. We serve one another. That's what the foot washing symbolises. And so you can't have one without the other. And so it is with the table, the third one. We have a table with bread and wine or juice, and we invite everybody to come and participate. And the participation is brilliant. Kathleen, at the end of her talk, will invite us all to the table and say, this is where you meet Jesus. No one can take that away. But as well as that, it says something about our ordinary tables. We should always open them up to others. The table is a symbol of the fellowship that we all share. And you can't have one without the other. So when you come to the table today, think about ways in which you can be sharing in community with members of this church and people who are not, especially people who are not, because the communion leads inevitably into the go of Christ. And at the go of Christ, we take Christ out to the world. That's part of our communion, part of the meaning of our table. So let's remember Jesus and everybody else when we come to the table today.
Is it okay? Can you hear me? Yes. Oh, now I'm afraid to walk around the stage, just in case I make some scary noises. Welcome, everyone. And it's really lovely to get to talk to you today. And we're coming into the season of Advent, which I really enjoy. I love getting ready for Christmas. I love putting the tree up on the 1st of December. I love Advent calendars. I particularly love Advent calendars, that kind of like day-by-day anticipation, looking forward to something really special that's coming. And so we're going to jump into Advent, even though we're still in November, coming into December. But this is a rhythm in the church community that's been established for thousands of years to use this time of year to really focus on the Christmas story, that really, really powerful story that changed the world. The story that's so powerful, it can bring down empires, it can upend the social order, it can transform lives and communities. So it's a really powerful, powerful story. But at Christmas time, we tend to tell the same story again and again and again, until it nearly loses its power. We've got this story of a baby, a mother, a father, a donkey. I don't even know why the donkey plays such an important role, but And it gets told again and again, and we do little nativity plays with the kids, and it becomes very much a Sunday school story, very much a children's story, and a little bit vanilla flavoured, a little bit weak and pathetic, loses something of its shockingness to us. And when I read the Bible, I find I'm particularly drawn to stories about women in the Bible. And the reason for that should be obvious. I am a woman. And so I want, as I look at this book, to know what roles there are for women. I want to know how women are treated. And I want to know the value that's placed on women, because my relationship with God actually depends on what I learn about how he feels towards me as a woman, how he sees me as a woman. And I have to admit to you that as a modern woman, when I read this text, I feel very, very uncomfortable. The roles that are given to women. Well, let's start with the fact that there are not very many roles given to women. It's mostly about men. Mostly the men get the action scenes, the men get the leadership roles, the men get to do all the fun stuff. When the women do feature, their stories tend to be sad, painful, and there's a lot of mistreatment and oppression of women written into the text. And when I look at what value's placed on women, it does appear that they're often given a minor role, often sidelined, silenced, and for me, that's very uncomfortable to read. But as I'm learning to read the Bible responsibly, I believe that we need to cautiously approach this text. We need to understand that the Bible comes to us, the Word of God, the inspired Word of God, but written by people in a context, in a time, in a culture. And so we have to take the time to understand that cultural context before we read and impose modern, Western, 2023, white suburbia, Wembley in particular, and try and read this text. And we also have to understand the literary genre, the design that has gone into writing this text, because I'm a speech therapist and a linguist. I'm obsessed with literacy. As a career, I actually teach teachers about literacy. So it really intrigues me, the narrative structure and the literary design of the Bible. And it is much, much cleverer and more sophisticated than most of us can see, because we've learnt to read and write as Westerners in English. And the text was not written in modern English. It was written in older languages, in ancient ways, when this was the only entertainment that people had, when people actually took the time to memorise and learn and to deeply ponder, to come back again and again and again and really take the time to understand the text. And that's something we don't do or we don't have, so it can be really easy for us to misunderstand and misinterpret the text. So given all that, when it comes time to Christmas, I get a bit frustrated with the fact that there's only one role for a woman at Christmas. And that's, who is that? Mary, yep. So she gets a lot of airtime around Christmas. And that's great. She does deserve it. But I'm really excited to tell you guys today that Mary is not the only woman in the Christmas story. There are a number of women in the Christmas story, and you may have never learnt to hear their stories and connect them with Christmas. And that's a shame, because these stories are not vanilla. These stories are not Sunday school stories. These stories are not even appropriate, probably, for you to bring up with your young children. And I'm not even sure if these stories are appropriate for me to bring up in church today. They're actually, I've been feeling uncomfortable about this, because it's so weighty. It feels important to me to treat these stories with dignity and honour. because unfortunately the Bible has been weaponized and used towards women across the centuries to make them feel small, powerless, voiceless, to impose a harsher code of conduct than is imposed on men. And I believe the Bible has been misused and misunderstood in those cases. I think that the authors of the Bible would have been horrified to see how it was used. And I often ask the question, does the Bible give honour and dignity to women? Because a lot of people don't think it does. A lot of people, Christians and non-Christians. And I think it does, but I think you have to understand the cultural context. I think you have to look carefully at the literary design to see it. I think, in fact, I would go so far as to say, and I'm going out on a limb here, I don't know if everyone would agree, but I actually believe the Bible treats women with more dignity and honour than it does to men. I think the critique and judgment is usually aimed much, much more harshly at the men than the women in the stories. But I do think that because of our cultural lens, we can struggle to see that. We can assume and imply, particularly as women, because shame comes pretty naturally to us. And so if it feels like shame, we're going to hear it like shame. So, you with me? So, I'm going to look at a part of the Bible. So the Bible is broken into two parts. It's not fair to call them two halves because if you think about it, the first three quarters at least is the Hebrew scriptures, the Bible as Jesus knew it when he was born, what we call the Old Testament. And this little section at the end is the New Testament, much smaller, but intensely powerful. If you think about what this text has done to transform the world and to transform the world for us women, it is an incredibly powerful set of writings. The New Testament has the Gospels at the beginning with the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, and then the New Testament history and letters in the short time period after that. And so you would think that such an important document should get off to a good start, that you should have some kind of amazing introduction that really grips people, grabs their attention, keeps them focused, kind of maybe gives them a summary of everything that's gone before and a hint of what's to come, maybe really gets their attention with something sensational, with promises of what it means to that person and really grabs the reader's attention. And that's what we've come to expect, because when you're scrolling through your phone, there's a lot of competition for our attention. And so we only click on the things that are really sensational or something that promises something particularly for us. So we're not used to things that are a bit more boring. And if you've got your Bibles, I'd like you to open up to the book of Matthew, chapter 1, verse 1 through to 17. And you're going to find possibly the most boring passage in the entire New Testament. Definitely the most boring passage in the Gospels. What was Matthew thinking? This is a genealogy. All it is a list of name after name after name. A lot of them too difficult for us to even pronounce. Definitely not the sort of thing that's going to get you excited or inspired or interested even in what the story is. So, what is Matthew doing here? But I have made it easy for you on the slides to kind of notice something that definitely would have stood out to the readers like a sore thumb. What is it? There are women in the genealogy. Women in a genealogy. And to understand what a big deal that is, you really have to know that a genealogy in ancient times did not have to include women. In fact, it would generally actively avoid women because it was a patrilineal, patriarchal society, and so that birthright was passed down from father to son, particularly the oldest son who had become the next patriarch. And so it was the men that were important in a genealogy. So if a woman appears in a genealogy, you know that it's particularly significant. You know that there's a spotlight on that woman. There's some special reason that she's there. So there are women in Jesus' genealogy. Can you call out the names of the women that you see there?
Tamar.
Going to start with Tamar. What's the next one you see? Rahab. So we've got two. Excuse my drawing. Not exactly lifelike. Ruth. Oh, Esther's in the Bible. I love the story of Esther. I have preached about it more than once. But she's not in the genealogy, but Ruth and Esther share something in common. They're the only two women in the Bible with an entire book named after them. 66 books, only two of them named after women, plenty of them named after men. So something particularly special about Ruth. And if we go to the next slide and look at the next few verses, we might find another woman. What's her name? What's going on here, I wonder? There's another woman, but she's not given a name, but I'm going to use her name because that feels honouring to me. So her name was Bathsheba. You might have heard of her. But for some reason, Matthew doesn't give her a name. We might circle back to that because what that implies to me as a modern woman is he's not giving her dignity. He's not calling her by name. But I would be cautious about assuming that's what's going on here because Matthew is damn clever. If you start digging into this genealogy, there are layers and layers and layers of meaning going on here. And for the readers who were willing to take the time and treat this like a treasure map and dig in where the clues told them to, you would find deep embedded theology in every verse of this text. And so I'm going to be cautious about assuming that Matthew is being flippant or disrespectful in the ways that he writes here. Okay, so we've got four women's names. So I want to get you all to show me with your hand how many of these stories you know well. Okay, so if it's zero, just put up your hand and say, and be honest, you know, I do not know who these women are. They're really obscure. They definitely weren't taught to me in Sunday school. Good. One or two or three or four. So everyone, put up your hand and show me how many of these women's stories do you know well? Okay. So we've got everything between absolutely nothing, right up to four. And a lot of you have kind of heard of one or two or three of them. Beautiful. These are obscure stories. These are not stories you would normally associate with Christmas. But trust me, Matthew has actually deliberately, strategically woven these stories in and made it very, very clear that these stories tell us something about Christmas. The way he's placed them tells us that we need to pay close attention. So one thing that the Bible does is, and one of the reasons it's really hard for us to read and understand in modern ways, is it uses different structures to commentate on itself. So instead of using words that we would understand, but like unfortunately, or it was a terrible thing when this happened, what the Bible does is it does not speak in words of judgment usually. What it does is it parallels things. It parallels, and you have to see the pattern to understand what the message is. So it will use the same words or the same structure or use something to kind of hyperlink with another part of the Bible. And if you know the text well enough, you make that connection, you go, oh, I see whether this was a good event or a bad event. I see what's going on here. So what we need to do, given that there are four women's names, and there's 40 men in the genealogy, before you get to the Holy Family, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, you've got 40 men, four women. So like I said, women don't get as many roles in the Bible. But when they are there, we need to pay attention and work out what is the common thread here. And I'm going to start with an easy one. There is a common thread with these four women, and that is they are not Jewish women. These are Gentile women. And that would have been shocking to the audience reading this. If they're looking at, you know, is Jesus a pure blood? Is he, you know, one of us? To have Gentile women included in the genealogy would have stood out like a sore thumb. So we know that Tamar was a Canaanite woman, and so was Rahab. So they lived in the land of Canaan, which is where the Israelites came in from Egypt and lived. Ruth was a Moabite woman. Whew, a Moabite in the genealogy. Oh my goodness, you need to do some serious digging to understand how scandalous that is, how shocking that is. And Bathsheba, who's not even mentioned by name, is called Uriah's wife. And Uriah was a Hittite. And so we don't actually know whether Bathsheba was Jewish or she was a Hittite, but just by the way that Matthew has crafted it, the spotlight is on the foreignness, the otherness, the outsider. And when you start to see this, you start to go, oh, okay, so the story of Christmas is linked somehow to the stories of others, outsiders, foreigners, being welcomed into a family. And if you go back even further to Genesis, you actually find out the origins of the Canaanites, the Moabites, the Hittites, and you start to see, oh, these guys, they're actually part of the family from the very beginning. They are just part. They are brothers who broke off. These are stories about fractured families coming back together. And this gives us a hint of what the whole New Testament is about, of what Jesus' role is, of what Paul is obsessed about in all of his New Testament letters, this unity, this fractured family needing to come back together, the Jews and the Gentiles finding their identity together in Christ. So that's beautiful. That's really lovely. But there's another shared thread between these four women that is not quite as beautiful or lovely. And I am hesitant to tell you guys because these women are all associated with some very raunchy, not PG, sex scandals. And that is a common thread, and we have to pay attention to it. So Tamar is probably the strangest, weirdest story for me to explain in the Bible, but I'm going to have a crack at it for her sake so that you don't judge her too harshly. But Tamar dressed up as a prostitute and lay in wait at the side of the road until her father-in-law, yes, her father-in-law, walked past and propositioned her, and she slept with him. Not your typical Christmas story. We don't want this in the nativity play. Don't even go home and try and explain this to your small children until they're old enough to hold a lot of nuance. Tamar, Rahab was an actual prostitute. Not only that, she was a liar and a deceiver because she hid some people, and when the king of her city came, she lied and said, oh, no, they went that way. No. And she sold out her people into enemy hands. Again, not someone that you're thinking of as a role model or a Christmas story. You're not going to see Rahab on any of your Christmas cards. Ruth, I mean, what lovely, sweet story Ruth is. Ruth is like the ultimate, you know, beautiful love story in the Bible. It's gorgeous. There is a sketchy scene in the book of Ruth where Ruth conspires with her mother-in-law, and then she bathes herself, dresses herself, puts on her perfume, sneaks down to the threshing floor in the middle of the night where Boaz is dozing off. He's had a hard day's work. He's had a celebratory drink. And she uncovers his feet, which is a Jewish euphemism. And in the morning, he says, make sure you get home before the sun comes up because I don't want anybody to see you. And Bathsheba, my heart bleeds for Bathsheba the most. Bathsheba is portrayed as this woman who on her rooftop was bathing naked right where the king could see her. She was a married woman and the king called for her and people say they had an affair or they committed adultery. So Bathsheba is painted as an adulterous woman. Whew. This is not the usual kind of topics that you talk about in a sermon. And somehow these women's stories point to Jesus. But what is Matthew doing? What is Matthew doing here? Why has he chosen these stories to highlight? Is he placing shame on these women? Is he maybe highlighting, oh, here are the sinful women, but wait till you get to, you know, the Virgin Mary. Like, oh, this is the contrast, you know, the not virgins as opposed to... No. That is not what Matthew is doing. Just in case you're worried. And trust me, I think the Bible has been read like that and will continue to be. But if you look at the original stories, this is where the cool bit happens because each of these women do carry great shame. And in a shame honour culture, that shame actually puts their lives at risk. It is shame, but the Bible is subtly but very deliberately placing the critique on dumb, foolish, irresponsible men who are mistreating women. It is shining a spotlight on women's issues, on the oppression and mistreatment of women. And those women go from a position of great shame to great honour. So let me walk you through some of these stories because they are really, really interesting, especially the story of Tamar. It's so... I actually find these stories really cool now that I can see that the spotlight is actually on the honour that these women receive, that these are the women... These women are the heroes of the story, not... Matthew is not slut-shaming them. I think that's just really important to say. Let's start with Tamar. To understand Tamar's story, you have to actually understand the social structure of that time, and it was a patriarchal structure, which meant that people lived in household groups of maybe 60 to 80 people, an extended family, and their servants and people associated with them. And the person who took leadership and responsibility for that whole group was the patriarch, the father. So it was called the father's house, the father's household. And so the patriarchs, and we hate the word patriarchy because it's come to be loaded with all sorts of other meanings, but the patriarchs actually were the good guys, or they should have been. The patriarchs had the responsibility for providing for and protecting the whole community. If somebody in that group got taken by kidnappers or something, they would have to lay down their life to rescue that person. They would have to, you know, raise an army and go after the patriarch. His honour depended on him providing for and protecting his household. So it was meant to be a really important role. But Judah, the father of the Jews, Judah, if you think of Jewish people, they actually get their name from Judah. Tamar was his daughter-in-law. Judah had three sons. Judah did everything wrong. Judah did everything that his culture told him not to do and that the Bible told him not to do. First of all, he married a Canaanite woman. He had these three sons and he definitely didn't raise them right because the Bible paints them as total jerks. And he married the first one off to Tamar. And the first son is a really important role in a patriarch household. The first son, if the father dies, he will get a double portion and he's going to take the responsibility to look after everybody on the father's death. But the first guy was a douche, according to the Bible, and he died before Tamar could have a child. And that was an issue. Because in that society, the three groups of people that fell outside of the Beit Av, the father's house, were widows, orphans, and foreigners. Widows, because the moment you weren't married, if your husband died and you didn't have a child, then you were not rooted in that household. You were kind of an outsider. And so the patriarch had a double responsibility to look after you because you're now vulnerable. So the widows, the orphans, obviously, are the most vulnerable. They've got no parents to look after them. So again, the patriarch has to take that particular role of particularly looking out for the orphans because they've got no one. And the foreigners, because they don't fit in the household. So again, the patriarch is called to give this extra amount of honour and attention to foreigners. And in the Old Testament, you'll hear it again and again till your ears bleed. Look after the widow, the orphan, and the foreigner. Really, really important in that social structure. So Tamar's now a widow, and so they've got this system built in to protect the widow. So the brother is meant to step up to honour his dead brother, his dead older brother. He actually has to marry his widow, sleep with her and get her pregnant with at least one son so that she can then, that son can inherit what the oldest son should have. She now has a place within the family. She's now protected. She's now got everything she needs. So it's an act of love. It's an act of honour. It's an act of a good man. It's weird to us, totally weird. We would not do this. But in that culture, this was actually how they provided and looked after each other. So Judah's second son turned out to be an even bigger douche because he happily took Tamar for himself to use for his pleasure and he chose to deliberately not get her pregnant. And so God didn't look kindly on him. He died. And Tamar's left in this awkward situation because the third son is not quite old enough yet to marry her. And Judah, that lying, cheating rat bag, said, "Oh, I promise you can marry the youngest one when he's old enough, but for now I'm going to send you back to your father's home," which was a way of bringing deep shame on her. He's not even taking responsibility. He's not even looking after her as part of his household. And she's stuck. Because she's now promised to the youngest son, she can't go marry anybody else. Like, or it's shame upon shame upon shame. This young woman has been deprived of what is rightfully hers, and this patriarch is acting like an absolute jerk. And he is the only person who can give her what she needs and what she legally is entitled to. And so when she takes off her widow's clothes and puts on the veil of a prostitute, she is boldly, bravely, creatively, heroically stepping into a space. She is unconventionally, she's got chutzpah, she's got sass, this woman. She is willing to put her life at risk, to take what's rightfully hers and to actually show up how Judah is behaving. And sure enough, she gets pregnant, he hears about it and he's in a rage, and it demanded an honour killing in that culture. So she's about to be burnt. It's like, it's a real high intensity. It's so foreign, it's so repulsive to us, this story, but it's super cool because she does the coolest move of all. And she, when she slept with him, she took as down payment some of his personal effects so that like she could return them to her for payment. And she sends him those items with a message saying, "The man who got me pregnant owns this stuff." And he's on the way to an honour killing, and his honour is challenged, and he realises, and he says, "You are more righteous than I am." And this is the story of the Bible. You are more righteous than I am. Righteous. A woman who dressed up as a prostitute to seduce her father-in-law is called righteous in the Bible. Can I have an amen? It's not your usual stories that you think of at Christmas. Rahab, she is one cool woman. Joshua sent in spies to check out Jericho because Jericho was like a border town full of soldiers and it was really in their way as they were coming into the land God had promised them. And so he sent in a couple of spies to check out the situation. And Rahab, the prostitute, took those spies in and hid them from the leadership of the town. And she said to the spies, "The reason I've taken you in is because I have heard the stories. I have heard the stories of your God. And he is the only God. He is the only God in heaven. He is the only God on this earth. And all I ask is, please, when you come for Jericho, please save me and my family, because yours is the true God." And she stood up to the authorities of her place, and she ended up. And the honour that's placed on Rahab to me is particularly cool, because not only was she and her family welcomed and incorporated into the family of God, but she gets a shout out more than once in the New Testament as actually one of the strongest examples of faith that there is. In the book of Hebrews, there's a who's who of all the greatest characters in Scripture. There's Abraham and Moses and Rahab. I don't think we can ever really understand what a big deal it is to be in the same list as Abraham and Moses to a bunch of Hebrews who are looking back at their history. She is elevated to the highest position that a woman can possibly have in the Hebrew history. It's beautiful. Ruth, I love the story of Ruth. It's really beautiful. And I do want to look. Scholars don't know what happened on the threshing floor that night. Nobody will ever know. Most don't think anything happened because this story is actually written in parallel with Tamar's story. And Tamar's mentioned in Ruth's story very explicitly so that you know that this is a similar situation. But instead of it being a patriarch story, this time it's just slightly different. It's about a kinsman redeemer, which is a similar role to a patriarch. A kinsman redeemer is if there is someone who is close to your family, they're not quite part of your household, but they're close enough that you're a kinsman, you have that moral obligation that if you want to, you could rescue them and bring them into your family, but it will put your interests at risk, your financial interests, the inheritance that your kids are going to get. And as Ruth approaches that threshing floor where Boaz is, she's not asking for a one-night stand. She is asking boldly, bravely, unconventionally, heroically. She's saying, "Please, marry me, because that's the only way that I can provide for my mother-in-law." Because Ruth was a widow, an orphan, and a foreigner at the same time. And the very worst kind of foreigner. She was a Moabite. Moabites were not even allowed near the temple. They said, if you marry a Moabite woman, you have to wait 10 generations before your children are even accepted as Israelites again. There was such a hatred of Moabites. And here is Ruth asking an upstanding man in the community, "Please overlook all that. I just come before you as a really vulnerable woman. I need you to actually marry me." And I think there's a romance there. I think Boaz was pretty pleased. He thanked her for her kindness. He went out of his way to negotiate. There was another kinsman redeemer who had more of a right to do that, or more of an obligation, I should say, and he refused point blank. He did not want to risk his interests for this foreign woman, for this Moabite. But Boaz was willing to. And that is actually a picture of Jesus, the kinsman redeemer, the ultimate one who is willing to put his interests aside to bring us back in the family. So it's a beautiful story. We'll never know. And I don't care what happened on the threshing floor with the uncovering of the feet. It does make for a delightful story. Lots of innuendo. Ooh, did they? Didn't they? Who cares? He stood up for her. He talked of her as a woman of virtue, a woman of righteousness. And if you've ever read Proverbs 31, most scholars agree it's written about Ruth. She is the woman of valour that's talked about in Proverbs 31. Now, these three women, it's really easy for me to see how they are heroes. They all did something really bold and brave. They all went unconventional. They all went to a Jewish man of high standing and asked for what they needed. Bathsheba's story is a little bit different, and I've actually been puzzling over where's the link, because in Bathsheba's story, she is not the active participant. She is a victim. And the Bible makes it really clear that it was not adultery that happened. It was abuse by King David. He looked out of his, well, not out of his window, he was on the roof. He looked out at a woman bathing in the middle of the night, and she was doing ritual purity bathing. So this was not some woman trying to flaunt it for the king. This was a woman doing the righteous request of the Bible. And he shouldn't even have been there. He should have been at war with his army. What was he doing perving on this poor woman? And in the text it says he saw her, he wanted her, he took her. And those are the same words that are used in Genesis 3 about taking the fruit, what Adam and Eve did. So it's very, very clear the Bible is being absolutely 100% clear that this was an act of rape or abuse. This was the king taking what was not his and doing the wrong thing by her. And so I kind of go, well, here we've got helpless victim, here we've got active, cool women standing up for what is rightfully theirs. I don't quite see the crossover, and I need to see the crossover because Matthew's trying to tell me something here. By the way, Matthew makes it really clear too that David did the wrong thing. That's why Matthew calls her Uriah's wife, not Bathsheba. It's not because he's belittling Bathsheba. It's because he's pointing the finger at David, saying, that great hero, that guy that you all worship and think is great, he was a douche. He did the wrong thing. So how does Bathsheba fit in this lineage of awesome superpower women who stand up for themselves? It actually comes later in the story when David's on his deathbed and one of his sons, let's see if I can say this correctly, Adonijah, one of David's older sons, is setting himself up as king behind David's back. And the prophet Nathan comes to Bathsheba and says, hey, your life is actually at risk because David promised that Solomon could be king, but Adonijah's trying to take the kingship because David's dying. You need to act now. And so Bathsheba actually goes before the king and begs for him to remember his promise to Solomon. And Nathan comes in to back her as well. So the timing's all very, very careful because Bathsheba's life is at risk if Adonijah gets the throne, and Solomon will also be at risk. And so in that act of heroism, of bravery, of boldness, of her unconventionally coming and begging for what's rightfully hers, she managed to save the kingship of Israel. She managed to put Solomon on the throne, and that was really important to fulfill what God had said, that the son of David would build the temple and reign over a great kingdom. And under Solomon's reign, that did happen. And Bathsheba was elevated to a place of honour through her son. In fact, there's a scene where she comes to visit Solomon and he puts her on a throne. So Bathsheba gets lifted from helpless victim to on a throne at the most powerful point in all of Israel's history, where they are actually like a dominant world superpower and at the height of the glory of the kingdom. But there's also that beautiful knowledge that prophecy about Solomon was not just about Solomon, because he was, again, a man with failings. It was also about the coming king, come now, Lord Jesus, the coming son of David, who would establish a temple on earth for all time and rule over the kingdoms of all the earth. And we get to be the living stones in that temple. So that is, it's all pointing towards the Christmas story. But if we look at the third slide, Kerry, there's one more woman in the genealogy of Jesus. And what's her name? Mary. We finally get to Mary. And this is where we see how clever Matthew is, because he's actually set these four women up. He's reminding his readers, hey, we have a long line. We have a long history and lineage of bold, brave women who faced shame, who carried great shame, and God honoured them. And so when he mentions Mary in the same setting, you actually start to reflect. And then in Matthew, it then goes on to describe a scene of Mary's shame, that when she was found out to be pregnant, the first thing Joseph wanted to do was dump her, and God actually had to persuade him to marry her. And her life would have been at risk, just like Tamar's life was, for the dishonour that she brought her community. And then the following scene, you have kings from distant lands coming and bowing down at Mary's feet as she holds the baby who is the king of the Jews. And so again, this beautiful reversal of shame to great honour. And that is why I love these stories. And they remind me that this is a pattern within the Bible. We do see women placed in places of great shame. But the Bible authors are actually trying to shine a spotlight on women's issues, on the gendered violence, oppression, and mistreatment that women in every time and every culture have experienced, to critique the men who cause those issues, but also to gently lift those women up and honour them and give them great honour. So again, I just love the stories of women in the Bible. And I'm going to ask that people come up for communion, because communion is a way where we get to live those themes of the Bible, those major themes, that major theme of the outsiders being welcomed on the inside, fractured families being restored to each other, that in our shame, men and women, God covers us with Jesus's glory, and we're raised to places of great honour. And so when we come together as a church and do communion, as you come to the front, know that there is a place for you at the table, a special place. And particularly if you feel like that outsider, if you're the widow, the orphan, the foreigner, if you're the poor, the sick and the lame, as they talk about in the New Testament, there's a particularly special place for you at the table. So I'm going to read the invitation to our table that we read every week. This is the table, not of the church, but of the Lord. It is made ready for those who love God and for those who want to love God more. So come, you who have much faith and you who have little, you who have been here often and you who come for the very first time, you who have tried to follow and you who have failed, come, because it is the Lord who invites you. It is God's will that those who want God should meet him. Come.
How good was that message? Thank you so much for joining us. Each week at West City, we say a benediction together. We do this because we believe that the purpose of the church is to be a caring community for the world, and that as we go and serve others, we enter into Christ's work of welcome, restoration and healing, both for us and others. We believe that in doing so, we get to see and encounter Christ. So let's say the benediction together. We come together as the church to be reminded of the go of Christ. So we will go out and feed the hungry, go out and clothe the naked, go out and fight for justice, go out and end oppression. Go out and proclaim anew the old, old story. Go out and associate with those who don't look like us, think like us, act like us, and don't even like us. And we'll do it all in the name of the one who sent us. His name is Jesus.